I think that's a big reason why we wrote the book. We just felt that there wasn't really enough out there for students to help them figure out what's expected in college and know what to do when they get to college. And as professors, we didn't really always have the time to actually spend going into this amount of detail and presenting this to students. So we were writing this blog once a week at US News education page on the web, and they said, just write about what you're thinking about now, what you're working on, what comes up with the students. And so something would happen in class, and I would wish I had more time to really go into it and really work with the student and really explain or deal with that problem, and I didn't have the time, so I would write it.
You know, when you prepare for college, or when you think you're preparing for college, you can ask your parents, but of course they may not have been in college for 25 or 30 years, so something taken for granted by students now, such as Skype, parents might not even know how that relates to the college experience.
Yeah, and one of the things that's interesting is how involved parents are nowadays with their students' education, and that's both a good thing and a bad thing, because sometimes, you know, parents are really leading the students in a way that would have worked when they were in college, but isn't working as well now.
You write in the beginning that this is the best time to go to college in the past 500 years, I think, right? Why would you say that?
I just think now there's an awareness, so much more awareness of the importance of going to college, and there's so many more people going to college, and especially here in Arkansas, we see a lot of people who are the first person in their family to go to college. And then we see a lot of people coming back who didn't finish college or started college or never got around to going to college. And I think now with globalization and with the realization that people in this country need to have more advanced skills in a lot of areas, otherwise their jobs will be shipped out and outsourced, I think now there is a tremendous interest in going to college. And on the other hand, from the college side, there's a tremendous awareness that they need to really think carefully and rethink the way they train the students and the services that they provide students.
When you think of the investment that a family or a student will put into college, and to some degree the investment the college puts into each student, it makes sense that professors, administrators, and students work together to try to get the best out of that.
On the one hand, I think professors would really like students to go well, to do well, to learn well, but I think professors are also very reluctant to give the recipe for doing well. Now, there are a variety of reasons for this. Sometimes professors simply haven't thought about it. Sometimes professors don't want to waste valuable class time. After all, there are only 40 or 50 classes available. But sometimes professors think that students are supposed to learn this on their own, that part of what it is going to college, part of what going to college is learning to do the hoops of college. This is something students are often badly equipped to do, we found.
One of the things I really like, though, about the book is here are 15 things to do the week before your college experience begins. They're sensible, they're straightforward, but you know what? There are people who don't have these in front of them and don't know about them, and it does make the college experience better.
I think for many students, the transition, the leap from high school to college requires a tremendous amount of reconfiguring. At high school, you have someone to stand over you, to give you quizzes, to give you tests. For example, my son gets grades every day on the web. He can look up how he's doing. The constant tracking and monitoring is totally absent at college. Professors might have 400, 500, 600 students in intro class, and they just can't track them one by one. And even the early, we now have early progress reports if you're doing badly in a course at the sixth week. You get a report back saying you're not passing the class. 6 weeks out of 14, the class is half done. Mm-hmm.
We've been teaching for a long time. I've been at the University of Arkansas for over 20 years now, and then I taught before I came here. But a lot of the things, I mean, everything that we have in these blogs are things that we've seen happen, or, of course, we have a lot of professor friends, and we talk among ourselves, and, of course, when something unusual or problematic comes up, we're always topic for conversation. But these are things that we have really seen happen. We've heard about happen, and so these are real things that are happening at colleges, and we know about them, but, you know, the parents and the students sort of aren't always aware of that. And so that's one of the things that we really wanted to communicate, because, you know, we hear from students pitfalls and problems, and we think that everybody could benefit from knowing about and preparing for them and hopefully averting them.
The other thing is the demographic of college has shifted tremendously in the last 10 years. For example, college is 60% women today nationwide, only 40% men. 40% of the students at college are over the age of 25. A lot of first-generation returning students. I'll tell you an anecdote from yesterday. I got a call from Eduardo Padron, who is the chancellor, the president of Miami-Dade Community College, which is the largest community college system. They have almost as many students there as they have in the entire University of California. And he had read a preprint of our book, and he said, I wanted to make some suggestions about your language. And I thought President Padron would say, get the word ass out. That's the most common comment about language I get. But what President Padron was interested in is a lot of places we were talking about studying with your roommate. And he thought that for community college students, there almost never is a roommate. And the simple expression, go talk with your roommate in a study group, showed a certain kind of bias and misperception of what the typical college student was. He wrote a blurb for the back cover of the book. And he offered a few complimentary words about how the book was useful and so on. But then he had a hyphen. He said, the book's useful for students of all ages. And I think in the American culture, when they talk about college students, we often think the average college student is 18 or 19 years old and male, has made a direct transition from high school to college. But a lot of times, if you have a student who's the average age, for example, Northwest Arkansas Community College in our area, the average age is 26, I believe, with the net result that the kind of transition from a work experience or a family experience or, you know, any kind of life experience to a college is often very difficult, because college is, in a certain sense, a very closed community. There's certain shared expectations that professors have that often aren't communicated clearly about, for example, having to do your own work, but also, for example, about having to prepare work in a certain way. One of the main tips we offer up in the book, and this comes up again and again and again, is the tip, always answer the question asked. We find that most students do badly, not because they didn't know or couldn't do, but because they don't answer directly the little question, the focused question that the professor is asking, often about just one lecture. Professors often grade by sampling, that is, by picking one salient question and figuring the student's answer is representative of the whole work. So I think there are many leaps. I don't think they're only the leap from home to school, from, you know, high school to college.
But from the military or from
a
job.
Job.
I think it goes back to what you were saying about there are just some things that are unwritten or not communicated well. And if you're coming to a new, you know, a university is like a city. It's like a different community. And I think there is a human nature that, well, if I don't know the rules, I certainly don't want to break them. It's personality type. Some people will bust through walls, but I think many will think to themselves, that's probably not the way it's done.
The other thing I think is that a lot of students think that the grades are held ransom to how they interact with the professor, an idea that if they do something wrong, it'll hurt them in the grade, which is a very funny thing, because the way grading is done typically is you have your three or four pieces of work, each one's allotted a certain percentage of grade, and one grades them firstly quickly. The average student would, I think, be surprised. We mentioned this in the book, to find that the average professor might spend 10 minutes on an exam or a paper. The other thing is often the grading's done without knowing who the student who wrote the paper exam is. Often done blindly or anonymously. And often the grader is not the professor either. In larger courses, for example, at the University of California, if there are more than 30 students in a class, especially in an advanced class, you typically would get a grader. This is complete outsourcing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't understand.
This is, by the way, I think something very shameful about American universities, that the people who are giving the lectures are not necessarily doing the grading, and that this, in many cases, is not openly disclosed.
The students that I encounter, I do think they feel like it's their fault that they don't understand or that they're having problems, and they kind of feel like it's imposition on the professor, and that, you know, and that it's, you know, their problem.
I think often it's a relationship much like people have with the medical community.
Mm.
There is a sort of, you are somewhat distanced. And you're afraid to ask. You don't know what the protocol is. You don't want to break the protocol.
So I think that's a good analogy.
And I think there are other elements in the course structure that reinforce that. For example, a lot of introductory courses, they have the textbook.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, for us teaching, the textbook is, you know, some interesting background information that might put you in a good position to understand the lecture a little bit, know some of the key terms or key figures or key events. But I think there is a cadre of students for whom the textbook is the Bible. Mm-hmm. Right? This is received gospel truth about the field. Now, the fact that somebody in 1972 wrote a book describing, biochemistry, some of these books, by the way, I learned with traditional textbook publishers have to go through committees of peers to review the information. It's some guy or woman sitting around for a year writing a book, giving his or her take of the field. It's not exactly like, Moses on Sinai wrote the textbook. Yet for many students, and I think this hampers the spirit of inquiry. I think the internet is something of a palliative to this. But even the internet, there are a lot of people who look for the site on Google, which will have the information which they can incorporate into their paper. I think knowledge is much more dynamic, and I think the people who are good teachers show the procedure of discovery in their own respective fields. I think that's very important.